Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Artificial intelligence has been all over the news lately. Cars that drive themselves, chatbots conversing with humans online, or simply the growing popularity of smart speakers that obey our commands. But while the conversation around artificial intelligence, or AI, might feel shiny and new, our guest today says it's been going on for a long time. And so today in The Exchange, nothing artificial here. We'll get the real story on artificial intelligence. Of course, we'd love to hear from you. When you think of AI, what do you think of? What are your concerns about it? What are your hopes? Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Helping us out this morning, tech analyst Rob Fleischman. He's principal architect at Akamai. That's a company which develops internet infrastructure and delivers web content to consumers. Rob, we really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much.
Laura, it's always great to be here.
So what's your best definition of artificial intelligence, Rob?
Well, it's pretty straightforward. Artificial intelligence is intelligence demonstrated by a machine, right? So a non-human. And, it's an area of computer science dominated by algorithms and all sorts of areas where we attempt to build things that act smart.
What's the difference between artificial intelligence and machine learning?
Machine learning is an area underneath artificial intelligence.
So it's related, but not exactly.
Absolutely. So artificial intelligence breaks down into a whole bunch of different categories. Things like expert systems, machine learning, deep learning, neural nets, all kinds of great...
Neural nets, wow.
Yeah, funky technology words. But, I'd say artificial intelligence is underneath computer science, and then you have all those little disciplines underneath that, which really illustrate different techniques and programming and technology that we interact with all the time in our world.
Well, and one of the things we'll talk about this hour, the main thing we'll talk about this hour, is how AI is already here in ways that we see and understand and in ways that we don't even realize. But before we get to that, Rob, so what isn't AI?
Well, Laura, I have to tell you, I wasn't sent here by our computer overlords to tell you that our time on this planet is almost over. That's not the case. We haven't built Skynet yet. We're not an autonomous, thinking, human-like structures. AI just hasn't really become the, HAL or, human-like thing that we're going to be interacting with instead of other humans yet.
All right. So for the uninitiated, remind us who HAL is. I know, but this is the fear of Terminator robots are going to say, okay, you squishy, fleshy humans, your time on Earth is over.
That's right.
Our turn.
That's right. Well, HAL from, 2001, The Space Odyssey, right, was a computer that basically decided, we weren't too valuable anymore, right?
He's the computer who is basically running the spaceship.
Exactly.
And at one point, he really runs the spaceship. Let's just hear this classic clip from the movie 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
I think you know what the problem is just as well as I do.
What are you talking about, HAL?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
I don't know what you're talking about, HAL.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me. And I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
I just love that scene. And yet I almost feel like I don't want to jinx myself laughing at it because... I don't know. Computers are pretty smart these days, pretty intelligent.
Well, Laura, your chess playing program might be great at playing chess, but it's not too good at deciding whether it wants to play another game of chess with you. So, it's really great at particular specific problems and rules, and it'll do a great job at that. But when we get into the world of unfamiliar and uncertain, where we have to make analogies and, you know, play forward different decisions that are complicated, sensing danger, self-awareness, those are areas of AI that are really under current research, and we're far away from that.
Well, and why is AI so overhyped sometimes in movies? I mean, you know, 2001 isn't the only movie to have, you know, robots say, I'm in charge now.
Oh, boy, the hype cycle. So now we're getting back to something I love, this guy Roy Amara, Amara's Law. Amara's Law says, we tend to overestimate the effect of technology in the short run and underestimate its effects in the long run. So let's play back some stuff. You know, do you remember CD-ROM technology, how it was going to change all of our lives? And then what did we realize? Well, we realized that CD-ROM technology was really just a lot of data available to our computer. And then we had broadband technology, right? That was going to change everything, right? Incredible. And what was broadband? Well, it was really high-speed internet, right? High-speed connectivity. Then we have the cloud, right? Everyone's excited about the cloud and big data. And, you know, what's really the cloud? The cloud is, using someone else's computer, not ours, right? And all of those things follow Amara's Law, right? We have incredibly great excitement for it. And then, which we, of course, overestimate how it's going to change our world immediately. But then long-term, it really infiltrates our world and becomes part of our regular lives, just like each of those things has, right? Broadband's become something we all just sort of count on, including on our phones. The cloud's going that way. CD-ROM, big data certainly has come that way. And I think AI actually, people don't want to admit it, but we use it all the time, every day, in almost everything that we use.
Well, let's talk about that. And
sure.
I'd love, Rob, just to illustrate this for people, give us a typical day for you. Now, you're a tech guy, so you may be a little more on that end already. But, you know, just as an example of how your day, maybe yesterday or maybe this morning, how artificial intelligence was just embedded in your daily life.
Sure, absolutely. So let's take a typical day. You know, you get up and you go to your coffee maker, right? Well, mine might not have Hal talking to me, but it certainly knows when the pot is empty and knows to shut the heating element off, right? So
that's
it has
handy.
A little feedback loop there so we don't heat the glass all day. A little intelligence there going on in my coffee maker. Then we, of course, fire up my social media and my, you know, finance pages, and they've culled articles that are interesting and important and relevant to me. They know that if I have a certain investment, they want to display news that's relevant to that. I hop in my car. I happen to drive an electric car. A lot of our viewers drive hybrids. Some people drive fancy luxury cars, Audis, BMWs, and what they don't want to talk about is that there's a lot of drive-by-wire technology in there. Sort of hard to see, but, you know, if you pull over and stick your head underneath the dashboard, you'll discover that your brake pedal and your throttle, I hate to tell you, they're not connected to much, Laura. They're pretty much connected to a computer. And when you press on the brake and it kind of feels like you're, you know, pressing
sure,
on something.
Sure, absolutely. I'm braking.
Yeah, that's the computer pressing against you, right? There's a piston back there that makes you feel like you're actually doing something. And people don't want to know that. People don't want to feel that this AI, that this computer is really running their car. But the reality is that our anti-lock brakes, right? Our cruise control systems, our traction control systems, our stability control systems, our crash prevention systems, they're all off of things like throttle position sensors or electronic braking systems, right?
So that's AI?
You bet.
Because it sounds very mechanical. It doesn't sound, quote unquote, intelligent.
Well, you know, let's be careful here, right? I mean, when we talk about AI, everybody thinks, well, it's some smart brain thinking. But what are computers really, really great at, right? What they're really great at is handling lots of inputs, right? Much faster than we can, right? I mean, you can look at 10, 20, 30 things per second, but when we start talking about thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds, millions of things per second, events, speed, brake position, throttle position, flow of gasoline, all sorts of things going on in your car at hundreds, thousands of times a second, computers are great at that. I mean, there's no way you can outbrake your anti-lock braking system. I mean, not a chance, right? I mean, it's so much better than we are.
What about the coffee pot, Rob? That doesn't sound very smart, again, but maybe it is. Maybe I'm not giving it enough
credit. Well, there's certainly levels of programming in each of those things. I mean, you're not going to buy a $10,000 coffee. Well, at least I'm not going to buy a $10,000 coffee maker, right? But you put the appropriate level of intelligence in each thing. I can't tell you how many people have smart thermostats now, right? Because they make sense, right? They're constantly looking at the temperature in your house and whether you're around or what's the outside temperature. And they're making optimizations all the time. And none of us want to sit and adjust our thermostat 100 times a day.
Sure. Turn it down when you're gone.
Absolutely.
Save energy.
But you have to remember to do that, right? And it's never going to forget, right? Because computers don't get tired. They don't get bored. They don't have a bad day. They don't get sick, right? They'll just do it all the time. And so I think that my day, everyone's day, is full of these things. And if anybody is logging into social media, oh my goodness, talk about AI there. The whole business model depends on AI.
Let's talk about that, Rob. But again, I want to remind our listeners that you can join us. We're learning more about artificial intelligence today in the Exchange. This has been in the news a ton lately. So we're finding out what it really means, what it is, what it isn't. Also looking at some of the fears that sometimes come up around AI. And a little bit later, we'll talk about what the future might hold. We'd love to hear from you. When you think of artificial intelligence, what do you think of? What are some of the hopes that you think this might bring? What do you think some of the concerns might be about the growing use of artificial intelligence in our day-to-day lives? Again, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So, Rob, we should talk about social media. One of the top executives at Facebook recently said, without artificial intelligence, we are dust. So they clearly think it's important. How does social media, and we can use Facebook as an example, how does it use artificial intelligence?
Well, there are a lot of companies whose business models are really based on giving you what you want. Right. And social media is certainly optimized in that direction. And it's not just the ads that it shows you. Right. And it's more than Facebook that does that. Right. All the advertising on all your websites and your email, et cetera, all looks for things that you're interested in and tries to show you more like it. And social media does the same thing. You know, your Facebook feed, whether you like it or not, is really delivered by AI. I mean, it's trying to say, OK, Laura, you know, it's Thursday morning. And what are the stories we're going to show you when you log in the morning? What are the stories we're going to show you in the afternoon? Which of your friends have something that you might find interesting? You know, if you happen to like the post that Rob made about AI, you'll see that. But, you know, if maybe you're more of a liberal arts person, you know, even though we're friends, you might not see that post, or maybe it'll be buried down deep. So it's trying to give you an experience that you love, that you enjoy, that's engaging. And it's really the only way to do it at scale. I mean, there are hundreds of millions of people accessing these sites. There are hundreds of millions of people sending email, going to Amazon. You know, you bought one thing, you want to buy something else. It's really the only way to build these compelling experiences for people. And we actually like it, right? I mean, we do. We're shopping more online. We're interacting with each other more. We're using these devices. They're compelling because they're customized for us.
I got a couple more questions for
Absolutely.
You on that, Rob. But let's
Absolutely.
Go to our listeners because we want to hear from you, too. Again, our number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is great, exchange@nhpr.org. Today, it's a broad conversation about artificial intelligence, some of the developments that are coming, and how it is really already embedded in many of our day-to-day activities. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And let's go first, Rob, to Goffstown, where Jack is on the line. Hi, Jack. You're on the air. Welcome. Jack, go ahead. You're on the line.
Hello.
Hi, Jack. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, it was Richard, not Jack. I'm
oh,
sorry.
I apologize. my fault. Yeah.
That's okay. I mean, I have to deal with some of this, quote, AI all day at work. I've been doing this now for 35 years. And I started off, AI was, you know, I mean, that was pipe dreams. Now people are constantly pushing it as, and your guest is one of them, you know, the end all be all of everything. And I'm sorry this is going to sound very nasty, but you're lying out your backside.
Woo, Richard.
AI is nothing more than very sophisticated, and I will admit they're very sophisticated, pattern matching systems. Neural nets, they all do this. They match what is out here versus what do I know? And then they make horrendous mistakes.
What's your business,
I
Rob, Richard?
These things all day.
Yeah, I'm curious.
I'm a database administrator.
Okay, yeah.
I'm a DBA.
Okay.
And we got people coming to me going, how did this come out of here? And I'm like, I have no flaming idea. The data is dead wrong.
Richard, I'm glad to hear from you. And Rob, in a way, even though he's kind of like, I think you're kind of, one of your statements earlier kind of agrees with him that there's a lot of hype around this. And, you know, we tend to read too much into it, into the short term and not enough into the long term. That's what you said at the beginning of the show.
Let me agree and disagree with Richard. I think that, first of all, the thing I disagree with is that I said that it's the end all be all of everything. I don't believe that either.
No.
You know, I think AI is a tool, right? And I think that AI needs to learn, earn its place in our lives. So, you know, I am not pounding the table telling you that it's going to be in everything and it's the best way to go. But, you know, where it's been useful is in areas where it has scale and could do things that we just can't do. So let me give you an example of things that just won't work, right? So we talked before about anti-lock brakes, right? Those things are everywhere, and they just don't work without AI. Now, Richard's right. You know, is it a feedback pattern matching system? Of course it is. Absolutely. What does an anti-lock braking system do? It takes position, acceleration, your position on the brake pedal, and it enhances you, right? It recognizes a pattern and applies it. So he's absolutely right. But that's actually how it works, right? Richard's a DBA. He understands a little bit more under the covers. He might understand how neural nets are built, how expert systems are built, how mini-max algorithms work, and search and pattern matching. And we can get into some of those crazy underlying things. And one of the things that's frustrating, and again, the man's right, and that is that when you're taking 100 million inputs per second and then making a decision, and here you are, the human being, you know, who, like he is, to say, wait a minute, the computer's decided to do this. Richard, why did it do that? Well, he has really no chance of understanding what all the inputs were that caused that output. So it can be frustrating when you're sort of the victim, if you will, of the decisions made by a very complicated system.
Let's take another call. Richard, thank you for that one. And Frank is calling from Belmont. Hi, Frank. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question, or my what I would hope your guest could possibly speak to, is if he could describe a little bit more about the difference between AI as we currently use it in things like cars and TV sets versus a machine that is self-aware, that actually has a capability of perceiving itself as an independent being.
Yeah, it's a big question, Frank. And stay on the line, okay, because I think we want to talk to you as well off air, get some more information. But go ahead, answer his question if you could, Rob.
So what he's talking about, really generalized intelligence, is you know, on the research path. I mean, AI breaks down into things like reasoning, knowledge representation, planning, natural language processing, vision. You know, some of the areas that are really state of the art now, where we're really trying to get toward general self-aware, is in areas like generated adversarial networks, which are things where, you know, I'm really going to get technical here, but where you train some AI software, usually a neural net, to recognize something. So let me give you an example. Let's take our typical cats example, right? So I train some software so it can recognize pictures of cats. And I do that by giving it thousands and thousands of pictures of cats. So it becomes really great at deciding what a cat is, right? And then I take another system and I play the two against each other. And the new system's job is to try and figure out how to draw a cat, right? So I have one thing that says, hey, I know what cats are, and one thing that's trying to learn how to draw a cat. And those are called generated adversarial networks. And those are really, you know, the next step that's really kind of state of the art, where we're trying to have systems learn from each other, become more aware of each other.
Thank you so much for the call, Frank. And you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So once this smart system or intelligent system learns how to draw a cat, I mean, partly I'm thinking, okay, so what? Like, what are the implications of that?
Well, right. So the
unemployment for artists? I mean, you know.
We can get into unemployment, but,
yeah.
You know, unfamiliar, right? That is really the tough thing for AI algorithms, right? I mean, when you have a known set of inputs, right, and they're bounded, whether it's a game. I mean, there's a great example. Years ago, there was a neural net that was learning to play Breakout, right? Everybody's played Breakout. You got your little bat at the bottom. You move back and forth, and you knock out blocks. And it was terrific. You know, after 600-700 sessions of playing, it actually got somewhat competent at it. But then any change to the system, you know, you make the bat a little smaller, you move it up the screen, maybe you add some blocks that don't go away, you know, some blocks that don't disappear, and all of a sudden the system played terribly, right? So these neural nets, they're data hungry, right? They need tons and tons of samples. I mean, Laura, think about it. You know, you don't need to show millions and millions of pictures of cars to a person so it can recognize a car, right? When a new car comes out, you can tell, well, that kind of looks different than the other cars, but I'm pretty sure that's a car.
Yeah, right? That's how a baby learns.
That's exactly. So I don't think we had to show millions of examples of things to babies. So clearly the technology in our heads with all these billions, hundreds of billions of neurons are really set up differently than the software that we're trying to build to help ourselves.
That actually makes me feel a little bit better.
It does.
So I can recognize a car faster than a computer.
Exactly. So I'm not too worried about you know, the general intelligence problem yet. Yes, are there people working on it? Are things like these generated adversarial networks, are they a step toward that? Sure. But now you're getting into, you know, questions really outside my expertise. You're getting into, you know, psychology, right? How the brain science, you know, that's interesting. I there are AI researchers who are saying, hey, let's try and write software that mimics the brain. But most of the research is trying to make things that are helpful to us.
Well, you're whetting my appetite to do another future show, maybe, Rob, with you and a philosopher and an ethicist and a scientist. So we'll
now
set that aside
deep.
For now.
You
but
are
that
going
sounds
deep there.
Great. So again, Frank, great point. Thank you so much. And here's a Facebook comment that came in from David, who says, the core problem for AI in the, quote, real world is figuring out how to ensure that AI systems do what they're supposed to do. Software verification of non-AI systems is problematic, but for AI, this is much more complex. And, David says, if we can't verify the AI does only what it's supposed to, how can we trust AI in safety-critical systems like autonomous cars? David, it's a great point. Thank you very much for the comment. And what do you think?
Wow, he's opening up a big can of worms with that. So the first thing to remember is that testing is always important, right? Testing of software systems, testing of complex systems, really, really important. And, you know, we have things like anti-lock braking systems today. We have adaptive cruise control. We even have things that keep your car in the lane, right? And those things are heavily tested. And I have to remind folks that we all fly in planes, right? And there are pilots who sit in the cockpit and have all kinds of buttons and steering wheels and pedals and all kinds of cool stuff. Not a whole heck of a lot of that is connected directly to, you know, the plane's propulsion system. It's all really done through computers. Of course, they're redundant. They're incredibly highly tested. And they're very important.
And if something happens, the pilot will take control.
Absolutely. They have different types of overrides and things like that. So it isn't that we're all blind. It's not that, you know, all these computer scientists and auto engineers are throwing everything to the wind and saying, hey, you know, let's just throw this stuff out there, right? We're worried about that stuff, too. And there's a lot of testing and a lot of certification for that. So I think, you know, I am concerned, but I'm not that concerned.
All right. More on artificial intelligence in just a moment. And your questions and comments, you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We'll be right back.
Every convention about how true crime stories usually unfold is upended.
That's why Bear Brook, the latest podcast from NHPR, has been downloaded more than a million times.
30 years ago this month, a mystery began.
It's the story of a decades-old cold case that's changing how murders will be investigated forever, reported by NHPR's own Jason Moon.
This story is not going to go the way you think it is.
Download it now or check it out at bearbrookpodcast.com.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, artificial intelligence, what it is, what it isn't, and how it's already so much a part of our lives in products and everyday settings that many of us don't even think about. We're learning more and we're hearing from you. How do you see AI in your own daily routine? What promise do you think it holds? What perils do you see? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or you can give us a call, 1-800 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Rob Fleischman is with us. He's a tech analyst. He's principal architect at Akamai. That's a company which develops internet infrastructure and delivers web content to consumers. And Rob, lots of listeners, you know, giving their opinions on this, asking questions. It's great. Fred is joining us from Wentworth. Hi, Fred. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you for hearing me today.
Sure. Go ahead.
I've been watching artificial intelligence and the related technologies of computer and their capacity and nano engineering, so forth, now for about 50 years. And over the course of that time, it's felt like things are moving at a snail's pace, but sort of coming together. And I had two experiences, one which is sort of irrelevant to this call, but I go to a venture capital conference with a small group in California, Palo Alto, once a year. And what I'm hearing there today is that, yes, Fred, you're right. We've been on the logarithmic growth curve for these technologies now for a very long time, and we have just hit the inflection point. If you think what you've seen in the last 10 years has been remarkable change, wait till you're 10 years from now and looking back on the past 10 years. I'd like your commentators to offer whatever they can as it relates to the impact of, as to whether they think we're in the inflection point, and
wow,
and the venture capital investors are investing on that basis.
Well, that's really interesting, and follow the money, right, Fred? And, you know, it's so good to hear from you, Fred, and from Richard, our earlier caller. You know, two gentlemen who say, hey, they've been in this business for a long time. A has nothing new.
Well, you know, Laura, first of all, I want to thank both those callers because they both make me feel young because I'm only 50 years old. So it's great that they have even longer perspective than me. You know, I find that I'm the oldest guy in the room now at my job. I used to be the youngest guy many years ago. No, not so much anymore. But, you know, they're right. You know, AI really started up. There was a Dartmouth workshop, 1956, where professors from CMU, MIT, Dartmouth got together with some guys from IBM. You know, there were names like Newell and Marvin Minsky, McCarthy, Simon and Samuel all got together. And, you know, it was really just a workshop. And they really kicked off sort of this idea of building intelligent machines. And they did a whole bunch of cool research in the 60s trying to build programs that could play checkers. And in the 70s, sort of research dried up. You know, it was all funded by DARPA, the, you know, defense contractor supplier, Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency of the government. And it sort of dried up in the 70s. It was, you know, kind of like AI winter, they called it. A lot of people have all kinds of theories as to why that happened. You know, my theory is that, you know, computers were big. They were slow. They were expensive. And funding a bunch of guys to play checkers, not as interesting as other things we needed back in the Cold War days.
Why DARPA got involved.
Exactly. So, you know, reborn in the 80s with some expert systems. And why? You know, again, a lot of theories as to why. You know, it would be great if we all thought that, hey, computer scientists today are just so much smarter and we're all just brilliant and we come up with clever things that the guys in the past never come up with. Not really true. What's really true is Moore's Law helped us. So Moore's Law is the old axiom about doubling capacity and speed of computers every so often. And that's really what happened. What happened is the machines got fast enough. Our processors got fast enough to handle the data rates and feedback that we need. You know, when you talk to Siri or Alexa, you know, they respond reasonably, right? If you said, you know, Siri, how's the weather outside? And 4 hours later, Siri came back with, Laura, it's cloudy outside. Yeah, that wouldn't be a compelling application, right? So we need the processing power, the networking, the data sources to be able to respond to you quickly. And that's really what I believe has caused a lot of the AI explosion, right? Which is, you know, the ability to read sensors. Again, we'll go back to the anti-lock braking situation, right? Think about how fast that has to work, right? You have to have computers that can process signals at thousands and tens of thousands thousands of times a second. And we just didn't have that. We didn't have it at the scale where, you know, the computer could fit on the back of your thumbnail, you know, and be able to do that, be light, be cheap, be resilient. And so that explosion of technology, as your caller said, and he's been watching it for 50 years, he's seen that. He saw computers that were slow and terrible, but the size of rooms, now he carries around something with a million times more processing.
Which really is amazing. I think the other part of Fred's question was a good one, though. Where is the money going in AI now? I mean, where are the sort of smart people with lots of money in their pockets putting that money when it comes to AI?
Well, a lot of great areas of you know, future research, but also commercial stuff, right? So smart thermostats are everywhere, right? Internet of Things, IoT, right? So being able to put, let's be honest, small computers everywhere that are connected to the cloud, right, but to the internet, where there are larger systems gathering data and allowing intelligent decisions to be made, those are getting compelling, right? A lot of AI, of course, as we discussed, in social media, advertising, trying to figure out what Laura wants to do next, giving her the ad or the opportunity to buy something to enhance her order. All of that is intelligent things that really turn into dollars. But also, you know, in medicine, oh my goodness, you know, we talk about self-driving vehicles, but and some people have, you know, concerns about that. But boy, I can tell you, you know, I'm 50 years old. When I'm 75 and my eyesight's no good and my hearing's no good and my motor skills are no good, I'm going to welcome the ability to hop into an autonomous vehicle and go visit my family anytime I want. It'll give me freedom.
Well, in fact, when the legislature talked about self-driving cars recently, there was some legislation about it. They heard from a lot of people with disabilities. They heard from a lot of older folks who said, please bring us these self-driving cars so, you know, we can jump in and get where we need to go.
I can restore my lifestyle, right?
Well, and speaking of medical applications, I want to play a little bit from the University of Pittsburgh. This is researcher Jeff Weiss. And this is from a video that UPittsburgh put out talking about their research into robotic arms. In this instance, they're developing a robotic arm for a gentleman named Nathan Copeland, a quadriplegic. Let's hear.
Essentially, he thinks about moving his arm, moving his hand. And so different neurons will be more or less active as he thinks about moving in different directions. And as we record from a whole population of those neurons, we can essentially decode which direction he's thinking about, whether he's thinking about opening or closing the hand, moving his wrist, and turn that into a control signal for the robot.
So think about what that means for Nathan Copeland, Rob. Just, you know, all of a sudden he has a hand and an arm that can move.
Absolutely.
It's hooked up to his brain.
Sensor technology, being able to read brain signals. I mean, you know, wow, that is just incredibly state-of-the-art stuff. And you know, we have a lot of that stuff going on in New Hampshire here, right, with Dean Kamen, the Luke arm. I still love, you know, really gets me choked up when I watch his video on the Luke arm, which I encourage folks to look at that TED Talk. It's like a minute or two. It's wonderful. But
just give us a quickie on what that is, because I have not seen it.
Dean Kamen is just an incredible person, really compelling. And, you know, he comes out in his blue jeans and his flannel shirt. And, of course, he's a brilliant technologist, and he presents the fact that the military came to him and said, you know, these guys come back from war and they have a hook, and you know, they basically have had a hook forever.
Yeah.
And they asked him to build something that really could allow a warrior to pick up a grape and eat it. And you know, he consulted with all these different mechanical engineers and, you know, computer scientists and sensor developers to build a prototype that allowed you know, people who are disabled that are missing limbs to function. Now, of course, this stuff is incredibly expensive and it's prototyped, but wow, what a revolutionary concept that we're heading down, the ability to give people who are disabled ability to live their lives again as normal people.
We could see an explosion of AI right here in New Hampshire, given the fact that ARMI, this regenerative tissue manufacturing institute, is, you know, right here.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Let's take another call. Lots of people want to jump in on this topic, Rob. David is joining us from Hopkinton. Hi, David. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank
morning.
You. Your guest just mentioned the Internet of Things, and recently I had a garage door opener replaced. They asked if I wanted the Internet module for my garage door opener. So my question is around the security of all of these things now attached to the internet. I can't imagine that there's a high degree of security built into all these things. They're easily hacked. What are the risks?
David, I'm so glad you called because there was a big hack, what, Rob, like a year or two ago, supposedly through the Internet of Things, these sort of less smart things like your garage door opener that is connected to the Internet. Thank you so much, David.
It's a serious problem, right? I mean, early set-top boxes were not secure, and the caller's absolutely right. You know, I'm a technologist, and boy, I would definitely refuse the Internet-connected garage door opener. And
you would refuse it?
I would, and the issue here becomes cost, right? Security is not free. Security is also dynamic. I mean, I work at Akamai. We have a huge business in security, right? We protect thousands and thousands of customers, the Fortune 500, all the banks. I mean, we do a lot of work in that world, and I can tell you it's a dynamic world. It's not one where you say, okay, we deployed our security and now we're all good, right? Because the threats are constantly changing. So when you buy your internet-connected toaster, let's be hyperbolic and just use the internet-connected toaster as an example, since that device really doesn't need the internet, but let's just go there.
You can still use your finger and push it down.
That's correct. You still can, but why does it need an internet connection, and how much more are you going to pay? How much money did they invest in the security on the toaster? I can assure you not that much, because you're not going to pay $1,000 for your toaster, whether it's internet-connected or not. So the problem becomes, how much did the company invest in security? Who are they? You know, is it some Chinese manufacturer under the covers that you've never heard of? And how does the device update itself, right? How does your garage door opener get the new software patch? And are you going to install that? And who's going to do that for you, right? These are major, major issues. So I'm very concerned about the security of Internet things. I agree with the caller. And candidly, we're at the beginning of that, right? So I think being an early adopter in that world, you have to be careful. Have to tread carefully when we're talking about security here.
Well, and for some folks, again, if you do have some significant disabilities, you might not be able to push down that toaster.
You bet. You bet.
And that's helpful.
That's right. So that's where the trade-off.
Door.
That's absolutely the trade-off, Laura. Absolutely.
Well, Thea sent us an email from New London, Rob. She says, you played an exchange with Big Hal, who takes over from humans because it, quote, knows better. This is not just an amusing, if paranoid, bit of science fiction. Thea says serious scientists are concerned and grappling with, quote, containment, exactly the problem posed by Hal. Thea says, witness the book Life 3.0 by an MIT professor, and Elon Musk and Stephen Hawking are on record as expressing concern. In fact, Thea says, there is an international group of computer experts and ethicists examining ways to develop international agreement on boundaries we humans will not cross. Thea, thank you so much. I was looking at some of this yesterday, actually, sort of as computers. Okay, maybe they're not HAL, maybe they are. I don't know. But as they do get more intelligent and more engaged in our day-to-day existence, are we still looking at some, you know, moral and ethical boundaries? So I'm guessing that's something you've thought a little bit about, Rob.
You know, you're talking about Animal Farm type things, iRobot, Asimov, you know, all those types of issues. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I'll even give you something a little scarier, Laura. What if I told you that they already control us, right? You go home and you see your teenagers, and what are they doing? They're plugged into their device, right? They're looking at their screen all day, right? And the computer is giving them dopamine all day,
because
right?
Because the AI has
done the feedback to make sure that they see the things they like, right? The games that they're given are immersive.
Just a little bit more.
They're unending, right? The games we grew up on, playing Pac-Man and Donkey Kong, I mean, they were nice, you know, but very repetitive, weren't quite as addicting. But now you get into things like Fortnite, which are completely immersive, and VR games where you're, you know, have a headset and you're in that world. And, you know, how far away is that from control?
Thea, thank you for the email. Something to look at more in depth in the future, perhaps. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. So, Rob, let's go back to our listeners. And Michelle's calling from Nashua. Hi, Michelle. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I have what might sound like an odd question, but just a little bit about myself. I don't have an Alexa or anything similar to that. I don't have a cell phone. I don't have cable TV. I keep on my laptop, I keep the microphone and camera shut off and have, you know, black tape over the camera. So my a few odd things have been happening.
So you're trying to stay somewhat disconnected, Michelle, it sounds like.
Yes, I am. I have a laptop, which I keep upstairs, and I always, you know, sign out of all the sites I visit. I always turn my laptop off when I'm finished using it, which I don't use it a lot. But
so what's your thought or question you want to share with Rob?
Twice in as many weeks, I was standing downstairs in my kitchen, and I was reminiscing aloud about how I used to watch All in the Family with my grandparents, and I just started kind of laughing at myself and the memories. Then I went upstairs, logged into YouTube, and there was a recommended video about Archie Bunker. And then another time, the week before, I was just thinking about something. I went upstairs again and turned on my computer, logged into Amazon, and it was right there on my page.
Wow.
And I'm just wondering, I don't really believe these are coincidences. Have you heard about these things happening, and how are they happening?
Wow, Michelle, what a story. Rob?
Fascinating, fascinating story. Well, I can tell your caller this, that everything that she does, especially on sites like Amazon, right, where you're browsing for
Now, we talked about Facebook earlier in terms of, you know, tracking your preferences, but Amazon is,
everything there is completely tracked, right? So they have built up a history, a profile of the caller, and when they log in, it takes a shot. It says, all right, you know,
see what happens.
See what happens. We're going to throw some content at this person that we think that might be compelling and see if they click on it. And sometimes they get it right, you know. And what's interesting about us, you know, it's kind of like learning a new vocabulary word. When you learn a new vocabulary word, all of a sudden you notice everyone's saying it, right? So it's the same kind of phenomenon I would throw out there. If when she went on Amazon most days and it just sort of threw something at her that wasn't interesting, she would dismiss it. But when it hits on something, your brain goes, hey, wait a minute. Didn't I just talk about this with a friend? You know, was someone listening to me? So the answer is that these systems are working all the time. Right. They're trying to customize an experience for her. And, you know, kudos to Amazon for doing a good job guessing the right thing.
Yeah. Although I'm sure
Michelle a little freaky. But yeah, I mean, it gets it right sometimes.
I remember like 15, 20 years ago, I just couldn't find the right pair of swim goggles in Concord. So I went online, you know, wasn't doing a lot of online shopping back then. And again, this was a while ago. Bought some swim goggles, and then the next time I logged in, and this is so obvious what I'm going to say now, but at the time, all of a sudden, you know, next to my email, the advertising bar or whatever you want to call it is full of swimsuits and goggles and bathing caps, and don't you want some new flippers? And now, of course, I'm used to it, but 15, 20 years ago, I was like, hey, that's creepy. How dare you?
There's a fine line
between
helping you and creeping you out.
Right,
exactly. Were you guys watching? Did you read my email? Wait a minute. My email is from Gmail. Oh my God. Google's reading all my mail.
Yeah, right. I mean, now it seems obvious. If this woman is going to buy swim goggles, then maybe she needs a new swimsuit. And, you know, lo and behold, she might click over here and buy a new one. But at the time, 15, 20 years ago, it did feel sort of big brotherish.
Exactly.
All right, Michelle, thank you for the call. Lots more of your calls and emails after a short break, so keep them coming. 1-800-892-6477. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, what artificial intelligence is, what it isn't, and why our guest says this topic often generates a lot of fear and a lot of hype. Let's hear from you when you think artificial intelligence. What comes up for you? Is it a hope? Is it a concern? And how does artificial intelligence already play a role in your day-to-day life? We'd love to hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Rob Fleischman, let's go right back to our listeners. Lots of questions from people today. Anne is calling in from Concord. Hi, Anne. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I'd like to know what an algorithm is. I have no idea.
Well, I'm glad you called because we kind of glossed over that, and we shouldn't, because listeners have a wide array of understanding of this topic, myself included. So I really appreciate the call, Anne.
Wow, that's a really great question.
It
Let's
is a
go
great
back
question.
To Computer Science 101, which is awesome. Love this stuff. So an algorithm. Let's see. I would give an analogy of a recipe. You know, how to bake a cake. You know, you start with your pan, you grease the pan, you put your flour in, your sugar, you mix it up, those sorts of things. And, you know, let's give a better, even better example of an algorithm. Let's say we are a computer scientist and we're trying to teach a computer how to play checkers. Right. So there's a famous computer algorithm called the Minimax algorithm. It gets really technical, but I'll try and boil it down really simply. You know, so I'm playing checkers against you, Laura, and I'm looking at the board and, you know, I'm going to think about my move. Right. Well, if I move my checker here, what are all the moves Laura could make? Laura might
move all the possibilities.
And then for every one of those possibilities, I have possibilities. Right. I can make a different move with certain checkers. So one algorithm that you might write, if you're a caller, is to look down that path to say, all right, if I move this checker, what are all the moves that Laura could make? What are all the responses I could make to that? What are all the responses Laura could make to that? And all of a sudden, very quickly, with just two or three moves, we have millions of possibilities.
And that's a lot of data that we can't process
that's
quickly.
That's right. We can't do it, right?
Like, but a computer can.
But the computers can. The computers love it and look at checkers and say, oh, you know, no problem. I can look 5, 6, 7 moves ahead and I can make a decision instantly. So that's an example of an algorithm. There's a little checkers playing algorithm where the computer says, what are the possibilities of what's next? And that's sort of an example of planning. It's a type of planning algorithm. And per your earlier caller who was a bit combative about, you know, AI being this magic end-all be-all, you know what? What I just gave you was an example of an AI algorithm. You know, yes, it's not this flashy HAL autonomous thinking robot. It's simply something that's doing searching across a tree of possibilities. But that falls under AI. It's not magic. It's just simple stuff. But it's done in a clever way that at the end, when you're playing the game of checkers against the computer, the computer appears intelligent.
Well, and you gave me a perfect setup for another little clip that I want to play, Rob. Not checkers, but chess. And a lot of listeners will remember when Watson,
yeah,
the computer,
sure,
played and won the quiz show Jeopardy. So there was a chess computer, and people were like, well, it's, you know, it's algorithms. It's just, you know, looking at possibilities. But Jeopardy seemed like another thing entirely, Rob, because it's like content, it's questions. But sure enough, Watson, the computer, won the quiz show Jeopardy in 2011 against two legendary Jeopardy champions. Let's hear.
Watson, who is Franz Liszt?
You are right.
What is violin?
Good.
Who is the church lady?
Yes. Watson.
What is narcolepsy?
You are right. And with that, you move to $36,681.
So my question is, what is Watson going to do with all that money? But but never mind. That was another step, Rob. You know, sure, I understand, you know, an algorithm or a recipe, as you explained it, can help you look at the help the computer look at the possibilities of chess or checkers. But Jeopardy seems a little different.
Oh, yeah. Pretty amazing. What you have there is stacking, right, of a lot of different technologies, right? So you have voice recognition, voice synthesis, incredible amounts of search into a very well-prepared database, right? This wasn't, you know, it really wasn't the processing that we do, right? We sat there, we listened to a question, we sort of looked in our brain and said, you know, do I have this answer? If I do, I'll offer it, right? But that's not at all the way Watson was set up, right? Watson was set up well in advance with tremendous amounts of data, incredibly indexed, optimized for Jeopardy, and it was really impressive. But on the other hand, you know, if you ask Watson to do something outside of the Jeopardy world, I suspect
you make dinner for me,
it's going to come up pretty short.
Yeah.
But you know, that's okay. It was a great example of optimizing for a particular set of constraints and constraints that were a little broader than what we're used to, right? What, playing chess, playing Go, playing checkers, those are well-constrained problems, and Jeopardy's a little less constrained. But the computer scientists, the folks at IBM did an incredible job of, you know, putting on an amazing show. And by the way, what they're going to do with that money is to try to slightly pay back the millions of dollars they spent
that it took
on
to develop.
That.
Yeah,
exactly. Right. Exactly.
Let's go to Craig in Sandown. Craig, thank you so much for calling. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Thank you, Laura. First-time caller, long-time listener.
Oh, awesome. Great.
I wanted to ask about some of the ethical context of artificial intelligence.
Right.
It seems to me, listening to your guest, that there's a little bit of a distinction to be drawn in terms of what we mean by AI. I noted that he talked in great detail about artificial limbs. And it strikes me that, you know, at the end of that artificial limb is a human brain making decisions versus, say, an algorithm, which is programmed by human beings, but, you know, in theory makes decisions on its own. And I'm wondering, how do we guard against the possibility, you know, like science fiction authors have warned us for, you know, 50 plus years, that eventually the decisions that are being made by artificial intelligence, by algorithms, don't conform to, you know, human ethical or moral standards. How do we protect the possibility of the future being guided by decision-making processes that don't take into account human values and focus mainly on, you know, making a profit or trying to improve your experience, etc.
Right. Or maybe the values of the creator of a particular product, you know, whether that be Google or Facebook or whoever. It's a big, big conversation going on right now, Craig. I'm so glad you called. And you touched on this earlier, Rob, but go ahead.
Yeah. So Craig brings up something that, you know, is hard to talk about.
Yeah.
And, you know, let me give you a specific example. And I agree with him. It's hard, especially an earlier caller was saying, hey, you know, this decision happened. I don't know why. It's too complicated for me to go back and figure out the millions of pieces of data that made the computer make this decision. But I'll boil it down to you. So, you know, we're fast forward some years in the future and we're, Laura, you and I are in our autonomous vehicle and we're driving down the road. And
no, our vehicle's driving down the
road. And, you know, a bunch of kids jump out into the road. Right? They jump out way too late. The car can't stop in time. Just can't. So the car has to make a decision. Does it swerve off the road to avoid the kids in the road, potentially endangering us, right? We might crash into a tree and we might be injured. Or does it hit the pedestrians?
Oh, yikes. So right? How does it decide between you and me in the car and the three or four kids in the road?
Exactly. And it's got to do it quick, right? It can't have a big philosophy conversation and bring in medical histories and who knows what. It has to make that decision instantly. And, you know, I don't have an answer for that, Laura. I don't. And, of course, you know, people who, you know, will argue back and say, well, what would you do? You're driving the car. What are you going to do? Same situation. Very difficult decision. But it's different when the algorithm does it than when we do it. Who is liable, right? Is it the car manufacturer, the algorithm developer, the owner of the car? Maybe we're in a self-driving Uber. Oh, my God. Things get very complicated very quickly. And, you know, those sorts of questions and answers are above my pay grade.
Well, and this speaks to something that we talked about earlier, that, you know, we should probably do another program looking at some of the ethical and moral issues around this.
These
today with you,
really
we're kind of looking
topics.
At latest developments and how they work and so forth. So really appreciate the call. Here's an email from Alice who says, I have a friend who works in the AI industry. He's in China right now and has seen a very invasive technology from a privacy standpoint. It tracks the pattern you walked in a store, records all items you looked at, and identifies your face and accesses your buying history by facial recognition. He feels we really need electronic privacy laws in our country. Can your guest comment on this? Alice says, thank you. Thank you, Alice, for that email. And I think that's not just in China. I've heard about that in this country as well.
Well, casinos are big at that sort of stuff, right?
Right.
Very, very big.
Where did he go? What did he do? Yeah. What is he like?
Is he on our list? Is Laura one of our card-counting people we want to keep an eye on? So privacy laws are critical, right? And a great example, in other countries, personal privacy is at the whim of the government. And, you know, they don't hold it quite as tight to the vest as we do. So what they're talking about is real, absolutely. AI, robotics really being embraced overseas. You know, there's another topic about, you know, whose jobs are the computers coming from. But, you know, our country, you know, as you've seen in the media recently, is a bit more sensitive. You know, there's been a huge pushback on social media. Facebook specifically has been called to task. I think that'll continue. And we're reactive, right? I mean, something happens and then the lawmakers go, oh, yeah, we got to make a law about this. We got to talk about this. So I think that's in the mix now. I'm hopeful that we'll come up with some boundaries that are a lot better than what the caller's talking about. And that's a legitimate fear. Absolutely.
Alice, thank you very much for the email. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Here's another email from Peter in Mount Vernon who says, your guest is conflating ordinary machine automation with what we would generally consider AI in the industry. Peter says, your coffee making shutting off when the pot is empty is not AI. ABS braking in your car is not AI. Peter says this is trivial sensor response processing. He says AI involves more complex processing and discrimination. Autocorrect involves AI. Google News involves AI. The websites that recommend stocks use AI. Your coffee maker, Peter says, not so much. Peter, thank you so much for jumping in. And Rob, do you want to jump in real quick on that point?
Oh, I think potato and potato. You know, I think certainly, you know, do you consider simple feedback systems AI or not? Early cruise control, was that AI or not? You know, maybe he's right. Maybe I'm being too simplistic. I'm trying to use a little artistic license to get our less technical people a little more involved here. But absolutely, you know, the real hot stuff are large data analysis, fast data analysis, neural network processing, high speed pattern recognition.
Spell check. Is spell check AI?
maybe.
Language, Google Translator, that's AI.
Certainly Google Translator, certainly. Because, you know, you're taking phonemes, you're cutting up speech into packets, trying to recognize them, trying to piece them together into words using probabilistic analysis, saying, well, it's much more probably, he said, take our jobs than some other thing. You know, a lot of clever algorithms, a tremendous amount of processing there. And yes, some of that early simple, hey, if it's too hot, make it colder. If it's too cold, make it hotter. Yeah, you could, you know, throw that off as just a simple feedback system.
Well, real quick, Rob, we talked earlier about some of the excitement around the use of AI in the medical field. Give us an example of some of the developments you've seen that hold a lot of promise.
Wonderful stuff. Really uplifting stuff, right? I mean, we're blessed here in New England. We can head down to Boston and visit some of the top hospitals where doctors are incredible. And, you know, not take anything away from them. I mean, they're absolutely incredibly smart people, but they also see complicated things, right? If you have a complicated problem, you want to go to a doctor who's seen it a million times. But now with AI, you know, you can have a system that analyzes hundreds of thousands of MRIs, and your doctor in some remote hospital can throw your MRI in the system, and the expert system can come back and say, hey, you know what? You should look at these potential diagnoses, not because I'm brilliant, but because I did the pattern matching, because I saw that when I see MRIs like this, I can compare them against tens of thousands of other ones, and here is the probable diagnosis.
Right.
And that's really valuable to a doctor who maybe doesn't see all those examples like they do in, you know, our high-powered hospitals in Boston.
All right. Well, we probably could have done a whole hour just on that last point, Rob, but thank you very much for helping us out, for being here, and I think we've got a lot more to talk about in the future. Thank you, Rob.
Wonderful being here, as always.
That's Rob Fleischman. He's a tech analyst. He's principal architect at Akamai, a company which develops internet infrastructure and delivers web content to consumers. And you're listening to The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.